the role of post-selection and probabilistic protocols in quantum information, there seems to be tension or some confusion about the role of post-selection in quantum information. It seems to me that there's two kinds of protocols. There's a fairly benign kind of post-selection, and then there's a more exotic kind of post-selection that goes on. The benign kind of post-selection appears, say, in optical quantum computing in the form of probabilistic sources. So we might have, prepare heralded photons by pumping a nonlinear crystal and waiting for a random event to occur where you get this twin proton pair, and conditional on detecting your photon in this arm, you know that you've prepared a photon in the other arm with some probability. And this is sort of a process, so it happens at a rate. And people have devised ways to multiplex such sources to increase the rate of single photon production. And in this sense, you can sort of remove some of at least you can increase the efficiency of such sources. And these are being built in like wave in integrated optics at the moment. We also see probabilistic gates in linear optics. So the problem is it's hard to get photons to interact. So ideally we'd like a strong nonlinear medium, and then we could get photon-photon interactions. But the kinds of interactions we have in nature are very weak. So instead, of a fairly clever trick was devised where you could sort of use a measurement-induced nonlinearity to perform quantum logic. So this is a figure I saw from Jeremy O'Brien's review paper. So the probabilistic part in this protocol is this blue box here, and that happens with some probability. And then after the initial scheme, so this is called the Kanell, Laflamme, and Milburn scheme. And after the initial scheme, various amendments were made to that protocol that could take the success probability of these gates arbitrarily close to one if you give yourself a lot of resources. So these, I would say, are sort of benign examples of post-selection in quantum information. Then there's the more exotic protocols, and that's what this talk is about. We're going to be talking about probabilistic noiseless amplification. That's the idea that you could take a quantum field and amplify it without adding noise. And in some sense, this is exactly equivalent to cloning if you have some stage. So the second part of the talk is going to be trying to do detection, which is another way of saying hypothesis testing, or maybe in quantum theory we'd say channel discrimination or state discrimination in a probabilistic fashion. So we really want to do this with discriminate channels with unit fidelity, and we can't do that perfectly, so let's see if we can do that probabilistically and perfectly. And the final part we'll talk about noiseless estimation. So can we there's known limits on quantum parameter estimation. Can we violate those limits on quantum parameter estimation if we can do something probabilistically? The last two are go under the names of weak value amplification and probabilistic metrology, for those who know that literature. So part one. The context of the study for probabilistic amplification is we're going to imagine that we have a single mode of the electromagnetic field, and we're looking at the E field, and the average of the E field is proportional to the real part of the annihilation operator. So in this figure here, I've plotted the expectation of the electric field operator here, and it's this solid blue line. And then the fuzzy blue stuff around it represents the fluctuations in that field. So this is like the variance in the field. So an amplifier takes this state, takes this field as an input and produces something that's bigger. In this case, it's G is 4. And there's an alternative way to think about this. If we plot this as a phasor, then the mean of the phasor is the mean of the signal. And the blob around the phasor is the noise ball. the quantum fluctuations, and this phase is going to be rotating in time like this. And in this picture, you see that the phasor gets displaced out here, and the noise gets bigger and bigger. So part of the the noise is for the experts in the audience. I've chosen symmetrically ordered moments of the annihilation operator, which corresponds to Wigner functions. So we're going to explore the noise in these amplifiers in the usual setting, which is an ideal linear amplifier. So amplification. So if we have an input to an amplifier, and we want it to be amplified, it's going to be amplified radially. And in classical theory, we would see that the noise ball would get amplified by the same amount. So the signal to noise ratio from the input, ratio of the mean to the variance, is preserved under this transformation. That's not true in quantum theory. The problem with it is that transformation doesn't preserve the commutation relations. So if you look at this operator here is the input annihilation operator. We want the transformation, the output is g times the input. And if you do the commutator in your head, you see that you're going to get a factor of g squared. And so therefore the commutator is not preserved. So the way to fix that is to include another operator, L, which we call the noise operator, and this corresponds to another degree of freedom from a different system. And when you do that and work out the commutator again, it implies that the commutator of L must be this. And that way you can preserve the canonical commutator from input to output. Usually we take the expected value of the noise operator to be zero. And that's so that at least in expectation, we can preserve this input-output relation. So, you know, on average, we should see this. So the point now is how much noise do we need to add in order to make this process unitary? And this was essentially what Carl Caves figured out in 1982. So he figured out the amount of noise you need to add, and that means this is the total input output relationship with respect to the noise that's added. We define an ideal linear amplifier to be the amplifier that adds the minimum amount of noise in quantum mechanics, and that's the one that saturates this inequality. And that's the one plotted here in this red line. So this is a unitary process. You can do it physically. One way to do this is to have a two-mode squeezing interaction. So the primary mode is the mode that you're going to amplify. And if the secondary mode is vacuum, then you will achieve this quantum limit. The squeeze parameter in the two-mode squeezing is the gain. So what's probabilistic amplification? So remember we said that the ideal linear amplifier, that's this red ball, is the one that saturates the bound for added noise. And that's physical. If we had a classical amplifier, then we would call that a perfect amplifier. It adds less noise than the ideal one from quantum mechanics. So we call the one that adds no noise an immaculate amplifier because it's better than perfect. And this kind of transformation was first proposed by Furasek and Ralph and Lund. It's a little bit misleading to think of this as just a displacement. It really has to act on all states in the entire phase plane and do the same operation. That's terrible color. So there's some green balls there. I don't know if you can see them. But so it has to map this state there and that state here and this state up there. So this can't be done with unit probability. In fact, there's a nice proof due to David Menzies and Sarah Crook that says that, so this is the operator that performs this transformation, g to the a dagger a. They have a nice proof that shows that In fact, if you allow this operator to act over the entire phase plane, then the strictly you need to, this happens with zero probability. It's not physical. Another way to think about it is the if you write down the this if you take this as one of the Krauss operators and you do k dagger k, you get k dagger k, then you can't get that to be less than the identity. So the question is, if we allow ourselves to have a device that works with some probability, p-check, it accepts an input coherent state alpha and outputs the state g-alpha. And we want to know, what are the quantum limits on this amplifier? So the way we're going to characterize it is with respect to its success probability and the fidelity with this target state g-alpha. Now, because there's no added noise, we can't characterize it in terms of these noise moments anymore. So this has a bit of history now. There's over 20 theory papers, and there's a bunch of proposals to improve key rates in QKD using these devices. Most of these QKD papers are in PRL. So the question is, you know, are these devices really going to be useful, or are we kidding ourselves? There's been a series of high-profile publications in Nature, something Nature Photonics and whatever. And at least from my perspective, they failed to answer the two important questions, which are, what are the quantum limits to these amplifiers? What are the fundamental ones? And do these amplifiers outperform the ordinary deterministic ideal linear amplifier? So that's what we're going to answer now. So the general picture you should have in your head while I'm giving this is you're going to have some primary mode alpha A, and it's going to go through this circuit, and we want it to be amplified to G alpha. And there's some Ancilla model that will let us do that, and the importance of the Ancilla model, although we're going to neglect it from now on, is that we can herald. So we're going to get a detection which says, yes, it worked, or no, it failed. The way we go about this is we start by assuming that there's a single Krauss operator, and we know that from the Menzies-Croak argument that this can't work over the entire phase plane. So we impose a restriction that it has to work on a finite region of phase space. So we're going to allow it to work on the first n plus 1 Fock states. And then the amplifying transformation is going to be mapping, so this is the projectrum to the first n plus 1 Fock states. The amplification is mapping this input state to this output state, whatever that is. And we want to judge that with respect to how frequently we can do it and how well it approximates this state G alpha.
So you mentioned various proposals for doing this.
Yeah.
So do they also, work on the same kind of region of the space?
So all the proposals end up working in a fixed region of phase space, very small region centered around the vacuum. And they, you know, there's different physical. So some protocols add thermal noise to the input state and then might subtract a photon, and this gives them an effective amplification. Other ones pass it through a beam splitter network and do photon subtraction. So the point of this analysis is which I hadn't quite got to, is we want to claim that we have the optimal quantum operation for doing this in terms of the success probability and the fidelity to the target state so that it's independent of the implementation.
Okay. But, maybe I should let you make the argument and then ask a follow-up question later.
Well, okay, I was just going to state it and not make the argument.
Okay.
So what I was going to say is that we add a few constraints to this. We're going to add that our amplifier is phase insensitive. So that means if I put a coherent state into the amplifier, amplify it, and then do a rotation on it, then that should be the same as if I first take the input state, rotate it, amplify it, then they should have, you know, fidelity with each other. And we're also going to require that our Krauss operator is physical. And with these two assumptions and a few other details, you can set up a Lagrange multiplier optimization, and we can work out that we can actually deduce the form of the optimal Krauss operator. And so the optimization is we want to maximize the fidelity subject to fixing the keeping the success probability fixed.
But it's optimized with respect to things of this form.
Yes. Oh, well, we deduce this form from the optimization. It's kind of, we set up the optimization problem, and then you start looking
within that class of things that you're optimizing over, the examples that people talked about all fit into that class.
They all perform, yes, yeah, they all perform suboptimally compared to the operations that we derive.
Okay.
Okay, so the the kinds of Krauss operators we get are very complicated, and we do another trick too. So this we kind of optimize things in terms of the nth Fock state, and there's another trick you can play, which is to allow the Krauss operator to be the identity past the n photon number sector, and that sort of increases the success probability and the fidelity of the entire operation. So here's some figures to help you get an idea of what's going on. The red curves here are the fidelity of the optimal amplifier that we derived. And we sort of denote a region, a working region. So we had this photon number cut off. In this figure, it's at 4. And the high fidelity region we find is at root n on g. And the reason why that is if you take a coherent state and amplify it by g, if it's at root n, then it will go out to, it's at root n on g. If it's here, when you amplify this state, it will go out to here. And then because the coherent states are Poisson in the number basis, then this is when the extent of the coherent state is starting to touch the n, not the root n, but the n cutoff out here. So that's when the fidelity of the amplifier starts to decrease. So that's the red line. The fidelity is quite high for small amplitude states. Then the success probability is quite low in this region here. And it starts to increase, but this is when we start to see that the amplifier is starting to do the identity operation. So now we have to start thinking about, well, is this doing better than a linear amplifier? So one metric would be to see what is the fidelity of the input coherent state to the target state. So that's the green line here. And of course, we can do that with unit probability. So from this perspective, the amplifier, it looks like the fidelity is better than that. Okay, that's good. But this is a probabilistic amplifier, so we haven't included the fact that it only works sometimes. So the way to include that is you multiply the fidelity by the success probability, and that represents the overall probability to achieve amplification. And that's this black line here. And the first thing you'll notice is the green line is above the black line. So one way to think about that is it's better to do nothing in this case, because with respect to this probability times fidelity metric, this is done with probability 1 and fidelity whatever this line is, and here we're always below that. And you can go even further. You can ask, well, how does a linear amplifier do with respect to fidelity times probability? The fidelity of the thermal state a linear amplifier produces is 1 on g squared, and this is done with unit probability. So in this case, g is root 2, and so again, we see the black line is below this deterministic amplifier bound. And it's even worse when we go to higher gains. So this is, root 2 is 1.4, so this is kind of no experimentalist would ever use a gain in an experiment like this. A gain of 4 is still considered small in experiments. So this plot down here is more typical of the kind of thing you would expect in an experiment. So again, the fidelity by itself is quite high. And now you can't see the success probability at all in this scale. The fidelity times probability metric is, again, invisible on this scale. So again, it's better to do nothing. The amplifier bound is this kind of this 1 on g squared line here, which is again above the performance of the immaculate amplifier. So it's pretty hard to see these figures, but I'll try to explain them anyway. So the way we interpret the features in this plot, so these are now plots, quasi-probability plots of the output of the amplifier. The red dot here represents the input state. That's the amplitude of the coherent state we stuck into the amplifier. And these contours represent the Wigner function. Yeah, that's a bit better. Okay. So when we put an input state well within this number cutoff region, it gets amplified to something that looks like a coherent state. These rings are fairly symmetric. As the input state starts to go past this sort of root n on g number cutoff, it starts to push up against this boundary and become squeezed in the sort of radial direction. And this is because we put this sort of hard cutoff in the number basis. When we actually hit the root n, we can see that we're starting to go back to a coherent state, and that was because there's identity. So 4 here is the, 3, so 9. We're starting to see part of the identity component of the coherent state, of the Krauss operator. And once we go sufficiently far out, then again, we're seeing that the amplifier is doing nothing. So the success probabilities we're seeing past root n here are really due to the fact that the amplifier is not doing anything, and it can do that with unit probability. So while this extension beyond the photon, the n ring, increases the fidelity here and increases the probability of success out here, it really doesn't do much to aid the amplification process. So we think the correct way, I didn't describe that. So in the limit of reasonable gain and small amplitude, you can sort of approximate this function here by this expression. So what this says is, as you increase the region of phase space that you're trying to amplify over, the probability decreases pretty rapidly. And furthermore, as you increase the amplitude, you have more problems too. So we think the correct way to describe the quantum limits for these immaculate amplifiers is in terms of the fidelity times probability product. And this is that product. The ideal amplifier has this product. And we don't think there's any sense in which the immaculate amplifier can outperform the ideal linear amplifier. So you can saturate this inequality, of course, by taking alpha to 0. So that means you're amplifying the vacuum and taking n equal to 2. So I don't know how useful that is, but. So I guess the summary of the story is I don't think there's any sense in which you can think of immaculate amplifiers as amplifiers, and I don't think, at least with respect to this performance metric, there's no way that they are useful. Yeah.
Yeah, so can you explain why you think that is the correct performance metric? I mean, I would think it depends on the application you have in mind.
Yeah. We've looked at other performance metrics, so signal-to-noise ratios, like anti-normally ordered moments and symmetrically ordered moments, and they all have this generic feature that whatever the performance metric you choose is, as soon as you include the success probability in the number of times you fail, then it always performs worse than the linear amplifier.
Well,
so one,
but again, depending on the application, maybe you don't care about that. Right, so let me give you a concrete example where, I mean, you kind of care about it, but it's not the primary thing. So you're an eavesdropper in a QKD protocol, and you know, Bob is used to dealing with a certain amount of photons that just don't arrive. So what you do as an eavesdropper is you put them through one of these probabilistic amplifiers, and sometimes it works, and then you can split off a bunch of light and keep it and send the rest on to Bob. And sometimes it doesn't work, and you know that, and then you block it, and Bob doesn't get anything, but he's not alarmed because he's used to that. So in that case, the probability of success is secondary, it seems to me.
Maybe I can sidestep this issue by saying another way to think about these probabilistic protocols is saying, I mean, if we can do this, well, maybe it doesn't sidestep. So, I mean, all of these probabilities are tiny, so you'd be waiting for successes for who knows how long if you have a sizable gain. So it might depend on how long you're willing to wait.
Right, but again, that seems to me like it's an application-dependent thing. Mm-hmm. So to say that it's never better seems like too strong a statement to me.
Right.
I can certainly accept that for some, you know.
Yeah, I did qualify that with respect to these performance metrics.
Okay.
Yeah, when I said that. Yeah, I mean, there could be applications that these amplifiers could be useful for. They're not the ones that we would traditionally use quantum limited amplifiers for. Yeah, perhaps if you're preparing resources offline, then it might be something useful to do. And if it is, then these are the bounds that we expect to see. Okay. This is the reference for this work. And we do it a bunch of other ways. We examine these same kind of protocols using state discrimination tools. So looking at unambiguous state discrimination, we get similar sort of results. So the second part of the talk, we're going to think about, rather than probabilistic amplification, we're going to think about probabilistic estimation and detection. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about what's called weak value amplification, and fortunately, the results are fairly general, so the results are fairly general and they apply outside of this area, which sort of led us to a second paper that we wrote on probabilistic metrology, and so these two topics are very related. Again, I'm going to ask the same kind of question. What are the quantum limits to estimation and detection, given that you're doing post-selection? How can we fairly compare protocols? And do these protocols outperform the optimal deterministic protocols? So some motivation for this might come from the gravitational wave community, where they have built these big interferometers and they're trying to detect the presence of a gravitational wave. And there's two sort of questions they want to ask. Did we detect a gravitational wave? And that's sort of a yes-no question. And then you might ask an additional question is, what is the waveform? And so if you detect a gravitational wave, that might lead you to Swedish gold. And if you can learn about the waveform, you might learn some interesting stellar physics, which could also lead you back to Swedish gold. So these are the two basic statistical tasks that are performed. And now we want to sort of formalize this and see whether doing post-selection is going to enable us to perform better than we could with a deterministic protocol. So the figure up the top here is the sort of scenario in the weak amplification protocols, and the figure down here is the sort of typical scenario in probabilistic metrology. So you imagine you have in the weak value amplification, you imagine that you have two systems, psi and phi, and they're going to interact with some unitary, and the Hamiltonian of this unitary has this form where it's some coupling constant x, and there's an operator on A and an operator on B. For the proofs that follow, we don't actually have to specify any more than that. This one could be finite dimensional, and this one could be bosonic. It doesn't matter. And we are going to measure this system here. So we've prepared it, and we're going to measure it here. And we're hoping that for some of the outcomes, we might be able to concentrate information about the interaction parameter x into the post-measurement state. So we're hoping that maybe one of the outcomes concentrates a lot of information and the other one might not. But we'll just use the outcome that has a lot of information. And then we're going to do parameter estimation to determine what x is, or we'll do hypothesis testing to see whether x is present or not, that is, x is zero or it's not. The situation in probabilistic metrology is a little bit different. We have a system and we impart a parameter from a unitary, and the thing we want to do is estimate this unitary parameter. And we'll give ourselves the freedom to interact this wire with another quantum system, and this will and do a measurement on this system. And again, we hope that this Krauss operator here, this conditioning that we perform here will somehow concentrate the information we have about this parameter x into this conditional state here. And in both of these protocols, after we've done this sort of conditioning step, we then need to do an optimal measurement on this system here and this system here in order to extract the information from that system. So that's the setting. We'll start with the weak value protocols. And we're going to, in order to judge the performance of these these two statistical tasks, we're going to use the standard statistical tools in detection and estimation theory. So for detection, the standard tool is hypothesis testing, and we're going to use a likelihood ratio test. So we're going to have two hypotheses. The null hypothesis is our sort of default position. That is, there's going to be no interaction. And the alternative hypothesis is there's an interaction. And there's four possibilities. Given a bunch of data, we could decide that it could be the case that the null hypothesis is true and we report the null hypothesis. Or the null hypothesis could be true, but from the data we can't quite conclude that, so we report the alternative hypothesis, and so on. What we'd like to do is minimize the probability of being wrong. And these are known as type 1 and type 2 errors. And the particular test we'll be doing is this one, the likelihood ratio. So we take all the data we've received and calculate the likelihood given hypothesis, the null hypothesis. Then we divide that by the alternative hypothesis. And if the number we get out of this procedure is greater than some constant, we report the null hypothesis. And if it's less than that, we report the alternative. And this constant C here, how you arrive at that depends on your take on statistics. So if you're a Bayesian, then this number here would include your prior probabilities for the competing hypotheses. And if you're a frequentist, you might appeal to Wilk's theorem, which says that under the null hypothesis, the distribution of this random variable here is a chi-squared distribution with n degrees of freedom. So then what you do is you take the expected value of that chi-squared distribution, and if it's greater than the test statistic is greater than that expected value, then you'll report the null hypothesis. If it's less, you report the alternative. That's kind of fairly technical, but that's what happens. And these are the hypotheses that we're doing. So we're going to maximize the alternative hypothesis over what X could be. But, I mean, why would anyone care about this hypothesis? Well, if you think back to the gravitational wave detection example, you don't want to report that you don't want to report false positives. So you don't want to you don't want to report that you've detected a gravitational wave when really there was none. So we're going to there's a theorem or a lemma in statistics called the Nyman-Pearson lemma, which says that this test that we're doing is the one that minimizes false positives. So that's why we're going to use the likelihood ratio test. So for estimation, we're going to use the performance metric of mean square error. And the way to think about that is if you have some parameter x that you're trying to estimate, then an estimator is a map from data to estimates. And we want the estimate to be accurate and precise. We will assume for what follows that our estimators are going to be unbiased. So in the limit of infinite data, then there's no difference between x true and the estimated x. So this curve will shift over here. And then we want to make the precision of our estimator as small as, well, I guess we want to make it as precise as possible. And the way we quantify the precision of an estimator is with respect to the mean square error. That turns out to be the variance of the estimator. And you're like, well, who ordered that? Why do we care about mean square error? So there's a nice argument, which is take any differentiable loss function, which is zero when these two things are equal and positive otherwise, and do a Taylor expansion around the true value, then you get this series. And now if you take the expected value of this, remember, so this term's zero, the expected value of this part is zero. So to first order, the only thing you care about is going to be proportional to the mean square error. So it's the sort of only important metric if you buy this argument. So we're going to use the mean square error. Unfortunately, there's problems with calculating the mean square error. When you have a nonlinear estimation problem, it's very difficult to calculate estimators and then the variance of those estimators. So instead, we rely on bounding the mean square error. And this is a trick stolen from classical statistics, where they have this thing called the Kramer-Rao bound, which provides a lower bound on the mean square error. So here, this parameter here, nu, refers to the statistical improvement you get with your estimator just from repeating a bunch of trials. So most people sort of ignore this in their analysis because you get that anyway. The thing you care about is this I term. So X is the parameter and rho is some quantum state. So this is called the quantum Fisher information. And the inverse of the quantum Fisher information bounds the mean square error. So this was first, I guess Hellstrom first thought about this in the 60s and came up with some way of calculating what's called the quantum Fisher information. And later on, Brownstein and Caves figured out how to optimize over POVMs, and at least for a single parameter, you can show that these two things are the same. For multiple parameters, then it's a different story. So you don't really need to know how to calculate these things, but what you do need to know is that the inverse of the Fisher information bounds the mean square error. So the rest of the analysis, we're going to be talking about mean square, these Fisher informations. So now we can turn to weak value amplification. And the sort of first analysis there's been a bunch of proposals claiming that, so in weak values, you have this interaction Hamiltonian, and typically this parameter X is very small. You do a measurement on the probe system, and then this depending on the outcome of that measurement, it gives you a large shift in the wave function in the other mode. And so you might think that that large shift is proportional to the the shift can be very large, and you might think that that might help you in estimating, but this shift only happens with a very low probability. So the first people to analyze this situation were Nee and colleagues from Oxford, and they showed for a particular example, they had two coupled qubits, and they showed that you were able to derive some inequality where the Fisher information of the post-selected state was actually exceeding the Fisher information of the full state. But when you included the success probability, that was no longer true, and they got some inequality like this. So in June last year, or maybe May, Chris Ferry and I saw a paper by two Japanese researchers, Tanaka and Yamamoto, and they were able to show fairly generally, so they only assumed this form of the interaction Hamiltonian and a basis measurement here. They were able to show that this inequality held in general in the limit of infinite number of trials. So that means if you do an infinite number of trials, strictly speaking, you will not estimate the parameter as well if you post-select on getting some successful outcome and throw out all the other data. And so this quantity here actually means we're doing the optimal. I should have explained that a bit earlier. So take a slice through here, and now we do the optimal joint measurement on both systems A and B. So this inequality should be read, you know, the optimal joint measurement on systems A and B is greater than a conditional measurement. Throwing out some of the data here and doing the optimal measurement up here. So you might think, well, that's not great. We'd like to prove something a bit stronger than that. And also this only held in the limit of infinite copies. So Chris Ferry and I sort of got very inspired by this paper and figured out a way to prove some very general results. Again, you know, only assuming this form of this interaction. So what we were able to prove is that for any finite number of copies, that the Fisher information obeys the inequality. So n check here is the number of times you succeeded in a run. So this is a random variable. So this means on average for any finite data, you can't learn more about the parameter by doing this post-selected strategy. You can learn as much, it's an inequality of course, right? But you can't learn more. So then you might ask yourself, well, what happens if we could, in some runs of the experiment, learn a little bit more, but on average we don't learn, on average we have to obey this inequality. So then we use a trick from statistics known as the Chernoff bound. So what we do is we bound the, you know, we bound the probability that this inequality can flip for some finite n. And so that's here. So the probability that this random variable here can exceed this is bounded by this thing. So that means that as the number of trials increases, you get this exponential suppression in this inequality being violated. So you may be able to violate for one or two measurements, but in the large limit, you won't violate it ever. But this still quite doesn't get to the root of things, because we've assumed that we're doing the optimal measurement here, and this is sort of unfair. We're saying these guys are doing they're doing a separable measurement here and then an optimal separable measurement up here. So it's still a little bit unfair. So we're able to do something even stronger, and that is prove for a separable measurement here and a separable measurement there that the Fisher information obey this inequality. So this is the optimal measurement. So if we do, so this is trivially true, you do the optimal measurement, you'll extract the optimal amount of information about the parameter. If you do a suboptimal measurement, then you obviously may or may not achieve that inequality. But the nice thing is that this part here is more like the kind of thing that's done here. There's a basis measurement and some other measurement here. And this also includes, for the experts, contributions from the classical Fisher information, so that is the statistics of the measurement results themselves, not just the quantum Fisher information. And it still obeys this inequality at this end here. So this at least I thought was a fairly strong result.
The middle thing, what's the measurement there? That's the optimal separable measurement?
So we allowed we allowed the, so in this inequality here, we're assuming that we post select on one or some number of outcomes. It could be a set. And then we do the optimal measurement here to extract the information. In this one here, we, instead of post selecting on, instead of throwing out the outcomes, we keep all those outcomes. So yeah, if you don't throw out those outcomes strictly, you have more information.
Sure.
So, you know, I thought this was a pretty strong result, and we this is the content of the first version of our paper that eventually got accepted. Now it's in the supplementary material. So the nice thing about this result, these results, is we didn't have to assume anything about weak coupling. We didn't have to, so the typical thing in weak values is expand to first order of perturbation and do this thing of post-selecting and exponentiating and, you know, but we didn't have to do that. We just got these results for free. However, okay, I'm going to briefly mention the probabilistic metrology setup now, before coming back to weak values. So in probabilistic metrology, they usually think about this unitary U here, that there's a unitary parameter that's imparted, and you're trying to estimate what X is. You know the form of U, it could be like e to the I omega sigma X, and you want to estimate omega. After we told, Chris and I told Carl about this result, he kind of challenged us to do it for mixed states, which we did pretty easily. And then the four of us came up with a way to sort of generalize the results I just told you about to any parameter imparted by any quantum operation. So it's not just a unitary, it could be, you could be trying to estimate the decay constant of an atom. And then instead of giving yourself a unitary here, you allow yourself any quantum operation here. And it could be conditional or unconditional. And the question, so the nice thing about this is now we can deal with noisy input states, and you could imagine this map here is, for example, a unitary followed by some decoherence process, or a decoherence process followed by some unitary. So, you know, we can, there's a lot of generality here. And we ask, can this allow us to estimate better? And in this paper here, we basically derive a series of inequalities that, that are identical to this kind of result that we had here, except it's for in a very general setting. So that's the content of this paper. But let's return to, and there was one other result. So remember in the linear amplifier, in the immaculate amplification, we had these fidelity times probability products. So in the probabilistic metrology literature, they usually quantify their estimation accuracy with respect to a fidelity. There's this very famous, I think it's Massar and Popescu result, where they show that if you have n copies of a qubit state and it's pure and you want to determine the state of the qubits, then the optimal measurement you do is a projector onto spin coherent states. It's a joint measurement. And that lets you estimate theta and phi, the two block angles. So there's a very well-known fidelity bound for that, and it's the average fidelity goes as n plus 1 on n on 2, where n is the number of copies of qubits. So in the probabilistic metrology literature, they look at this and see whether if they can do a post-selected measurement, whether they can increase that fidelity how accurately they estimate the block components. And we were able to prove using a fidelity measure, so this was all Fisher information, and in the last part of the paper we were able to sort of translate our ideas into the fidelity language and show a similar inequality. So this is the optimal measurement, and then this is the fidelities of the post-selected measurement, so when you get a success and when you get a failure, and that is always, these fidelities are always greater than this. The trick that's usually played, which I guess Daniel was alluding to earlier, is if you don't care about the success probability, you can kind of renormalize everything by that. So if you divide everything through by the success probability, then then these fidelity, well, this fidelity in particular seems a lot higher. But if, I mean, if you're going to do that in this inequality, you have to divide everything through by the success probability. But it just doesn't make sense over here. So I don't really know how to think about that. All right, I think I'm pretty close to finish. So there's been a lot of objections to our papers. So I mentioned that what I thought was the main point of the paper is now in the supplementary material. So these were the sort of six objections, and I was going to go through them in detail, but I think I can just explain them to you in words. So the first objection we got, you notice that I didn't do hypothesis testing, I did all this Fisher information analysis, was the point of weak value amplification is detection. We want to detect the presence or absence of this parameter. So then we went and proved similar inequalities for hypothesis testing, and that was good for us. And then people started saying, well, no, you've missed the point again. The point is that, sure, you can't improve estimation and detection accuracy above and beyond the quantum limits, but when there's technical noise, so that means there's noise at the input, you've got imperfect operations, or your detector's noisy, or your after you've done your protocol, there's some decoherence, then your inequalities won't hold anymore. So we and other people have modeled many different kinds of technical noise, not all, we can't do it exhaustively. I mean, you saw the kind of general formalism in that last slide. This covers most of the noise at the input. People have specific models of detector noise. It depends on what kind of detector you have. And Chris and I even modeled things like Gaussian correlations in so correlated noises. So again, every time we've done this, we've come up with the same series of inequalities. No one's yet to find a violation of these inequalities. We always find the same form of the inequalities. So then the third objection comes down to optimal estimation is difficult, and that's true. It is hard. This is why classical statistics and estimation are still alive fields today, even though they were founded hundreds of years ago. But that's life. One of the interesting things is while we were trying to sort of rebut this comment, we found that we could derive sort of simplified estimators, which actually turn out to be very similar to the kind of things that are done in weak values. And this showed us a second reason why the weak value amplification protocol is not a good thing to do. So the first reason is there's post-selection. And sort of naively from statistics, you expect that throwing away data is always bad. But the second reason why weak values are bad is when you, so to do this example, we had to expand to first order and perturbation and go into the real messy details of weak values. When you do that, you can explicitly work out the variance of the estimator rather than bounding it with a Kramer-Rao bound. So when you do that, you can determine the optimal estimation strategy. The optimal estimation strategy corresponds to having small weak values, not large weak values. So typically in the weak value literature, they think that having a large weak value will make you more sensitive to a parameter. And our results tell us that, in fact, having the smallest, if all of the weak values are equal and small, then that's the optimal way to estimate and detect these parameters. So that was kind of an interesting result. So there's two reasons why post-selection and also large weak values are suboptimal. Finally, the fourth objection to our results has been you only considered real weak values, not imaginary weak values. And imaginary weak values had already been considered in the literature, but real weak values and imaginary weak values are just defined quantities. There's nothing inherent about them. So the proofs that we've done in this paper here cover all defined quantities. So if you want to define quaternionic or topological weak values, they're also included in this proof here. So it's kind of a moot point, we think at least. The next thing is people say that we make the wrong comparison, that what they'd like to do is compare some experiment A, where you do optimal estimation, and some other experiment, which is designed differently, and you do suboptimal estimation, so you use like a weak value estimator. And if the Fisher information of this experiment, uh, sorry, if the if the mean square of this experiment is better than that one, then you've succeeded. But this doesn't make sense. You need to compare optimal if you want to do experimental design, at least this is what's done in classical statistics, you need to compare the optimal estimator for this experiment to the optimal estimator for that experiment. Otherwise, you could get the case, if you're comparing two suboptimal estimators, that you might actually be doing the wrong experiment. And then the other point is, people have pointed out that you can almost achieve the equality in our inequalities. And that's true. We have also pointed that out ourselves. It could be the case that, so this is often billed by the proponents of these techniques as sort of a new technique in quantum metrology. And I guess the point that we're trying to make is that, it's not like you're violating any of the quantum limits to metrology that we know and love. It's it may be that the techniques that you come up with enable you to think of new experiments that would be very difficult to think of if you just sat down with a pen and paper, and so perhaps weak values can inspire you to think about these experiments, but they don't actually aid estimation or detection. Just before I finish, I think there's two categories of probabilistic protocols. The benign ones seem to correspond, so this was single photon sources and doing probabilistic gates. They seem to correspond to processes that are allowed by quantum mechanics. And usually you can make the success probability approach as close to one as you want. The more exotic probabilistic protocols usually correspond to a non-physical process, and typically they correspond to trying to increase the distinguishability of channels or the distinguishability of states. And not always, but often the success probability is quite low. One of the interesting questions to push forward would be, how would you, we've kind of got this form of inequality where we have performance metric is less than or equal to some post-selected performance metric. So is there a way to sort of say, well, maybe I'll back up. So if you had these these inequalities all held on expectations, so on average, it's not possible to increase the distinguishability of channels and states. So then the Chernoff bound was telling us, well, even in a small number of trials, it's not possible to flip that inequality around the other way. It's not possible to increase the distinguishability of states and channels. So I think a future direction would be trying to prove something like that more generally. So without relying on a particular metric like Fisher information or likelihood ratios or fidelities, just try and think, how could you do that? If we could do this on average, then we'd break the no cloning theorem. We can't do that. If we could do it probabilistically, well, it has to be the case that it can't work out in the long run. Probabilistic protocols are an attempt to evade the no-cloning theorem by praying the quantum gods won't be paying attention all the time. One of our main results indicates that the quantum gods are keenly alert and they don't suffer this kind of hubris gladly. And by that I mean that in most of these protocols, the performance of the probabilistic protocol is much worse than that of the deterministic protocol with respect to the performance metrics we've chosen. So thank you.
Questions for Dr.?
Yeah.
So when you listed like some of the common objections, there is one I was hoping maybe you could expand on your response to, that optimal estimation is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the way you responded. So, is it possible that you could get some sort of a computational advantage where maybe the optimal estimate involves solving some very difficult problem, but a suboptimal estimate gives you it requires less computational resources to implement?
Yeah. So the particular thing that we're that we were criticized on this point is we assumed that we could calculate the optimal estimator for a noisy stochastic process. So this in general requires calculating, or first estimating, a covariance matrix of that noise. And so once you estimate the covariance matrix of the noise, then you can go and try and do your optimal estimation. And that's, you know, it's a tricky thing doing that. There are sort of, you can do, the field of digital signal processing, they have like algorithms, well, they have procedures where they can online estimate like the noise properties of a channel. It's so hard to say until I see a specific example whether it's going to be intractable problem or not. But yeah, I think you're right that in some cases these quick and dirty estimators are going to be fine. But if the point of your experiment or the point of your paper is to talk about parameter estimation, then you probably want to be using something as close to optimal as you can. So we had Rana Adhikari from LIGO visit a couple months ago at UNM, and the kind of lengths that they go to make their estimators good for LIGO is incredible. They're all experts in machine learning and statistics. So it's hard to imagine that a tabletop quantum optics experiment can't use more optimal estimation.
Do you expect your result to hold also in the multi-parameter setting?
Yeah, actually, that's the other one that I left off this list. In general, the technique we've leveraged is the fact that the Fisher information is the inverse of the Fisher information bounds the mean square error. When you go to multiple parameters, then you've got a lot of problems because now you've got a Fisher information matrix. And generally, you can't saturate that bound. But I don't see any reason. I mean, to answer your question, aside from that problem, which happens in normal quantum parameter estimation, I can't see any reason why these inequalities would change when you pass to multiple parameters, unless there was some. I can't see any reason.
I mean, presumably, it's always the case that if you do the measurement, the weak measurement setup, and then instead of post-selecting, you keep all the information and do the optimal estimator based on that. That can't give you less information than keeping only one outcome.
Exactly, yeah.
It just might be more complicated.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's the intuition.
So you could imagine just a situation where your post-processing of your data is just incredibly expensive, time-consuming. And then you just want less data.
Yeah. Yeah, it could, I mean, so the way we, I mean, one of the things I didn't talk about related to this, I guess it's both related to this optimal estimation is hard and technical noise. So I mentioned in the technical noise, we're able to prove that having large weak values is not a good thing if you want to estimate. So when we started thinking about this optimal estimation, we were able to show that, I sort of intentionally didn't talk about weak values in this talk because all of these results you can derive without explicitly having to define weak values. But the usual scenarios you mentioned that there's some meter state which has a broad wave function. And one of the things we were able to prove was if you make the wave function sufficiently broad, you can kind of cancel some of the noise. I was saying that, you know, if the noise on top of the meters is correlated, then you have to estimate that covariance matrix. And that could be, you know, an n by n covariance matrix where n is very, very big. So if the meter wave function is sufficiently broad, then you can do these like series expansions on the estimators, and you essentially get the estimator that is used in the weak value community, except without throwing out the data and not making the weak value large. And I think that would be very efficient. So that way, you know, in that situation, even though you have a lot of data, the estimation part's very easy. Did that satisfy you or not so much?
Partially. Yeah.
Okay.
Any urgent questions? Maybe not, then let's thank Joshua again.
Thanks.